From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, we're talking about the decisions voters will have to make in November. Not about the candidates, but about issues. And you'll have some big questions to answer, like how committed are you to getting more money into the public education system? Do you support medical marijuana? Do you want to expand Medicaid? Do you want to strip partisan politics out of the redistricting process? There are more ballot initiatives this year than we've seen in years. So today in the program, we're talking about them. After this. Hey, it's Doug Fabrizio. Come see the latest in our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Next Monday, we're showing Madeline Olnick's film, Wild Nights with Emily. It's not a documentary. It's a narrative feature about the real Emily Dickinson. Olnick corrects these myths about Dickinson that she was a delicate sourpuss. In fact, she says she wasn't. She was passionate and funny and inspired by love. Join us at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center next Monday night at 7. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're planning on voting next month, you've got some big questions to answer. Questions that Utah politicians have been arguing about really for years now. These are questions they haven't managed to resolve completely, or that they've put off, or that they voted on but left some people unsatisfied. So you have these citizen groups who've stepped in and put these questions directly on the ballot. They can do that. And there are questions like this. How committed are you to getting more money into the public education system? That is, would you, for example, vote for a gas tax increase to do that? Do you support medical marijuana? That's another question. Do you want to expand Medicaid? That's another one. And here's another one. Do you want to strip partisan politics out of the redistricting process? We have more of these questions on the ballot this year than we've had really in years. And so today in the program, we're going to break down some of these initiatives, which means we'll have to give you the backstory. We'll have to talk about how these issues got on the ballot in the first place, what they do, what they mean. We'll also talk about their chances of passing, but also whether they will stay intact after lawmakers get their hands on them. We invite you to join the conversation. You may have your own questions or comments about this process. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here in the studio with us is Julia Ritchie and Nicole Nixon. They both cover politics for KUER News, and welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
And Benjamin Wood is joining us. He covers politics and government for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's also host of their Trib Talk podcast. And Benjamin Wood, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
So let me begin broadly. And Benjamin, to you, how unique is this that we have so many of these initiatives on the ballot? Sometimes we don't have any, and we haven't had any for a while, I don't think. Now we have four. How unique and how significant is that, do you think?
It's quite significant. We came close with Count My Vote a couple times,
yeah.
And you know, the legislature stepped in before that could happen. So in my memory, I can't even think of the last time we had a citizen-driven initiative or even just generally this many questions, amendments, things to consider outside of candidates and offices.
And what do you guys think that means that we have? I mean, is it just circumstance or does it reveal something larger, like a trend or a flaw in the system, you know, or a disconnect between voters and lawmakers, that you have these citizen groups who are just, they're not taking no for an answer and they're putting these things on the ballot?
I think that's a good point. And a lot of these issues are issues that the legislature has come together, debated, either passed the buck on or did something that was less than what citizen groups had hoped for. And so over time, these issues had time to build coalitions. The coalitions had time to build support. And I think you can't ignore the election of President Donald Trump galvanizing some of this as well, and making people want to take more action themselves.
What do you think?
I think earlier this year in the legislature, there was some of these issues came up. We saw the compromise with the Our Schools Now initiative, which is now a non-binding question on the ballot. But again, this year, there was kind of some franticness at the legislature, and you saw bills coming up that would undercut some of these, the Our Schools Now is an example of that. But I think that of voters saw that the legislature was just passing the bare minimum on some of these, like medical marijuana, for example, and some of these voters are really angry about it.
What does it mean when issues take on these groups of supporters outside of the legislative process and try to get it directly to vote? I mean, what does it say about the legislature? What I'm interested in is that what seems to be this kind of disconnect about between – I mean, clearly this is a conservative state. Voters tend to be more conservative. But are they as conservative as their lawmakers? And does this initiative process sometimes reveal a disconnect, do you think?
I think it does. And I think that the Medicaid proposition is a great example of that, too. The legislature started arguing about this and medical marijuana as well in 2015. And there was broad public support for both of these issues. And I'm thinking of Governor Herbert's Healthy Utah Plan, which would have expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. People wanted this to pass, but the legislature did not pass it. And you're now seeing support for – you're seeing the fact that this Medicaid proposition is on the ballot, and I think you're seeing polling support for it.
I was going to say the medical marijuana initiative stands out to me. I mean, mm-hmm. the law that we have on the books could not be more conservative. If you're at death's door, you can legally possess and use marijuana. And the voters in the state have clearly shown they'd like to something slightly more liberal than that.
Yeah. What do lawmakers think, Julia, when voters do an end around around them? I'm not sure if it's accurate to exactly call it that, but it seems like it is. I mean, what do lawmakers make of these initiatives?
So the big quote from last session, I'm sure you all remember, Representative Segmiller, was it, in St. George, said, "I'm nervous about empowering the public."
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was for a bill that did not pass that would have actually subverted some of these ballot initiatives and delayed their implementation. It did not end up passing. But again, I think it highlights, again, what you said is the disconnect between what voters would like to see happen and what lawmakers would like to control. And I think that's been the real tension in the state is between the legislature trying to micromanage certain issues and the public trying to push through things that there is broad public support for.
We should also explain, when you win on a ballot initiative, that does not mean it's over. Constitutionally, lawmakers still have the final say. And Ben, talk a little bit about that. They can go in and change and alter the initiative in any way they want?
Yeah, they have the final and the ongoing say. If these things pass, they become a law like any other law, and we'll have a session right around the corner where they can amend, repeal, change, adjust. It's just yet another thing on the books that the lawmakers can play with at their discretion.
So what difference does it make to pass these if lawmakers can go in and do the tinkering? I mean, I guess it does change the dynamic of the debate, right? You are seeing compromises that you might not have seen. You are seeing movement that you might not have seen in the past.
Yeah, it's bringing people to the table that might have been resistant before to some of these issues. And it's also just a lot of these initiatives are aimed at helping people. And so do you really want to be the lawmaker running for re-election saying, "I voted or I changed a law that would help fewer people as opposed to more people"? So I think it is about public pressure and public opinion.
Yeah,
winning hearts and minds in these debates.
If a proposition passes as well, do you want to take the political risk to change that and then, like Julia was saying, go before your constituents and subvert
the will of the people?
Exactly.
Yeah. But is there – can they act with impunity though? That's another question I guess you probably can't answer. But how expensive would it be if you voted against, if this initiative passes over? I guess that's a question though. If these initiatives pass overwhelmingly, that's one thing. If they just barely squeak by, I guess that's another.
Yeah, and I think we'll see that test case after Proposition 2. We've been told that this initiative looks likely to pass, at which point a completely different program will be put in place. If voters dislike that, I guess we'll see over the next 2 years how much voters dislike that or like it or what happens. We just don't know.
What do we know about the – we're going to talk about the particular groups who are supportive of these initiatives. But I wanted to – Ben, you've been writing a little bit about this group, Americans for Prosperity. This is one group – probably the most outspoken group in opposition to some of these, those that involve
tax increases.
Mm-hmm. Americans for Prosperity. It's a group funded by David Koch. What do we know about this group and how they work?
Well, I had the chance to sit in on their phone bank one night. It was a relatively small group of volunteers just frantically making as many calls as they could to warn people about these tax increases. But you're right. I mean, there aren't that many organized voices of opposition this year. We've seen a lot for the medical marijuana debate. But on these other questions, question one, proposition three, proposition four, it's kind of just been left hanging out there for the voters to decide. So there is this small group of volunteers. They're making calls. Perhaps some of your listeners have gotten those phone calls and been warned about how we're spending so much money on UTA instead of schools. That's one tactic out there, and we'll see how effective it is.
Yeah. They have a lot of money? Koch's got a lot of money. Do they have a lot of money?
You know what? Their disclosures are – they got off to a bit of a later start than some of these pro-initiative groups. So we don't have the documents that we have for things like the Utah Patients Coalition or Utah Decides Healthcare. They got off to a late start. So their next disclosure form, we'll see. But as of right now, I couldn't even answer how much money they have.
Yeah.
I will say that's an interesting point. All the propositions don't have a lot of organized opposition against them. So there are groups now coming, like Americans for Prosperity. But for the large part, these propositions have been kind of proceeding forth without a vocal opposition group up until Drug Safe Utah formed their coalition against Prop 2. So
yeah. All right. Well, let's dive in. Let's start with this question one, formal title, non-binding opinion question number one. So exciting. This is the ballot, one of those ballot items that did get a sign off by lawmakers that, and this is about education funding. Somebody tell us what this is. Question one.
Everyone's looking at me.
We should say Ben used to be the education beat reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. So
and you can take me out of that beat, but you can't take the beat out of me. Now, so what non-binding question one does, you know, a compromise was struck and some money has been given to schools already. Mm-hmm. That is done. There is a second component that is this non-binding question where the legislature is asking voters, if we were to pass a gas tax, increase it by 10 cents per gallon, would you all be okay with that if we put that money towards education? So it's, you know, there's different numbers. It's in the neighborhood of 100 and something odd million dollars for schools, both public, you know, K-12 and higher. Local road projects will get some money as well. But what voters are being asked for is to send that message, are you or are you not okay with this scheme?
What's so interesting about it, and I want you all to explain how we kind of got to this point, because this was the, and it seems like this is often the case in some of these ballot initiatives, where you have this proposal and then it turns into a kind of a compromise, they work through it. And this particular question is the result of a last-minute compromise with this group, Our Schools Now, who agreed to set aside this ballot initiative they had in mind, which was super ambitious. They wanted to get, what was it, 700 and...
$750 odd million
into the education system through an increase in income and sales tax. That was pretty ambitious. So they started the negotiation process, and just explain how this went, because what they ended up doing, this group, is settling for less than half of that and maybe even a quarter of that.
That's right. I mean, if the gas tax is put through, we're looking at maybe half of what they were initially asking for. If the gas tax question fails and that doesn't get put through, then yeah, maybe a quarter to a third. I mean, again, the numbers are always moving. These are estimates. But you're looking at something between $200 and $300 million instead of $750 million. Now, they've never said this out loud, but you can't help but wonder if they were intentionally punching for a really big number to get something in the $300 million range at the end of the day. We don't know that for sure. That's not something they've wanted to disclose. But when you look at how this came together, there is this appearance of, you know, aiming for the back of the head to hit something in the face.
Right.
Polling on this was always a little 50-50-ish, even in the early days of when it was going to be a ballot initiative. And so by the end, and this was in the last week of the legislative session that they came to the table and did this deal, the backers of Our Schools Now said that they had always wanted a legislative compromise, that this is not them giving up or taking a lesser deal. It's because this was actually the outcome that they had hoped for, was something that the legislature would do, knowing that tax increases on the ballot are not that popular, both with the legislature and with the public at large.
Yeah. Is that true? Like voters are, they're not, I mean, you see polling that says when you ask voters in theory, mm-hmm. hey, do you support giving more money to public education? People always say yes. But I guess this is the question. How much do you support it? Like, how much of a tax would you be willing to abide? I guess that's the question here.
And I think that made them nervous. I mean, again, like you say, like, you want to support schools, but are you willing to increase your income and your sales tax or even your gas tax to do so? That's going to be the question. And the last poll with the Tribune, right, shows like 56% opposed.
Opposed, yeah. Our last poll says that question one's underwater. And that's a bad place to be going into the election, because everyone will tell you're likely to lose points on a question that involves a gas tax. Tax.
Any tax.
Any tax.
So right now it doesn't look good for this particular question. What does that say about voters?
Well, I don't want to make a value judgment on voters.
No. You don't have to make a value
Julie
judgment.
Julie Rich, you think voters
suck.
Are garbage.
Yeah.
No. It's not a qualitative question.
Yeah.
The question is whether they're uneasy with raising. They don't want to raise their taxes. That doesn't say anything about
it. I will say Governor Herbert has made this sort of the linchpin of his tenure is that he's the education governor. And he has put in a lot of money into education. Ben probably has the numbers like right off the top of his head, but it's something like $1 billion over 10 years or something like that.
Something like that.
And so every year they hear that, right? They hear this message, we're putting more and more money into education. At some point, if you're a voter and you're not that clued into exactly the nuts and bolts of how much, you're going to say, well, isn't the governor already doing that? Or isn't that really the governor's responsibility to figure out how to do that? And I know that's become an issue, too. And we were just talking beforehand about the governor is in favor of this compromise. And he's done one ad.
Mm-hmm.
But the legislature hasn't really rallied behind this very much either. And they're the ones who are supposed to be sort of encouraging voters to vote for it.
And question one could not be more complicated to explain as far as a taxing structure for schools. And there's something about the gas. I mean, anyone who drives is acutely aware of how much gas costs.
Yeah.
And when you tell them 10 cents more, it's easy to feel that. I mean, a sales tax, you know, pennies on a purchase, it's less present than a gas tax increase.
I think people feel that. They're like, that 10 cents, that seems like a lot.
Yeah, we've been driving around all summer and, you know the difference between what you're paying now and what an extra 10 cents would be.
Yeah, and the question of, like, if it's a gas tax increase, why isn't it just funding roads?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you have to explain, well, actually, you've been taking money out of the education fund to help fund transportation. This will no longer offset that, and that gets really wonky and boring to people.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the Our Schools Now group. They've been at this for years now.
They have.
And they have some kind of influential people.
Oh, they're a who's who of prominent Utahns. I mean, and that's why this was always such a serious – when they launched their initiative, we all took it very seriously because this was a serious group. Big money, big names, the Chamber of Commerce, you know, the kind of folks that you see in the news a lot. And, yeah, and that's why when they did announce this compromise, it did seem like a sincere good faith effort to work with lawmakers, because these are the kind of people who do work with lawmakers.
This is one of two tax increases on the ballot this year. The other one is Medicaid, which we'll get to. Julia, do you have a sense that voters are being at, like, pick one or pick both? Or this seems like such a big question for lawmakers, and it seems like it's going to send a really big message.
Right. I don't know if voters are thinking, I'm only going to support one over the other.
Right.
And Medicaid is quite a bit more popular, and it's been done in other states. So voters can look to other states as a model for what a Medicaid expansion actually looks like. Whereas, again, a non-binding question, they're not voting to raise the tax. They're voting to send a message of support that the legislature should do so. So if my money was on one, it would be on Medicaid over the non-binding question, which is hard to explain.
Nicole, one of the things you've noticed is that support for this isn't necessarily, or doesn't seem to be necessarily related to party affiliation or whether you have kids in school.
Right. I've talked to Democrats who oppose this because they don't have kids in school and they're wondering why they should be subsidizing that through their gas tax. I've talked to Republicans who would normally oppose a tax increase, but are supporting this one because they're so frustrated with the lack of funding that they're seeing in schools. I really think that support and opposition for this one is all over the map. So for me, I mean, the polling number looks a little bleak for this one, but I guess we'll see. I mean, we could see support from places we wouldn't normally see support for something like this.
I'm not going to have you predict the success or failure of any of these necessarily, but right now you'd say chances, odds are don't look so good for this one.
I would say for any of these.
You're supposed to preface it. If I was a betting man.
No, I would say for any of these initiatives, if you're not in majority support now, then you've got a really tough hill to climb.
I will say also, though, that a lot of these polls were conducted over the summer, and now that people are getting their ballots and we're heading into election season and these ad campaigns are ramping up, I'm seeing a lot of ads for question one. I'm not seeing a lot of ads opposed to question one. So I think people are still trying to make up their minds on this one, and maybe we'll see some support flip.
Okay, let's move on. And before we get to a break, I wanted to talk about Proposition 2.
Woo!
I'm just going to woo after every song.
I mean, this is the main event. I thought you were wooing.
Well, this is kind of the main event, and we've spent a number of programs of this particular program talking about this. This is, of course, the initiative about whether Utah should legalize medical marijuana. Let me ask the same question I did about about question one, and that is, how did we get here? In the sense that, what kind of impasse does this reveal between lawmakers and voters on this particular issue? This was something that lawmakers, as you've said, they thought they had sort of settled this. This was, we'll allow it within this last 6 months of life and we'll be done with it. But clearly these citizen groups, and what seems to be, if you look at polling, a lot of Utah voters are not satisfied with that. That seems to be how we've ended up here.
Yeah, and lawmakers, they like taking an incremental approach on things like this, and they signaled that. They signaled that, you know, 6 months to live bill was not their final say on this issue, but that they needed more time, more research. And essentially what we saw was the public at large saying, we don't need to go so slowly on this, especially when the nation at large has moved well beyond where Utah is.
Yeah. So what are I guess the thing that we need to say about this is the latest development, this compromise that's going on. Talk a little bit about this compromise between supporters and opponents now, and lawmakers have gotten involved. And this is the development that I think we should talk about, because this is the most interesting part. This is the new development. Julie, give us a sense of what's going on.
So I guess the bottom line here is, regardless of whether Proposition 2 passes or fails, the legislature will convene after the election on November 6th and hold a special session to hammer out a compromise bill that would more tightly control the cultivation, distribution, and dispensing of marijuana. And this was a deal that was struck between the legislature, the governor, and at least two out of three of the groups backing Proposition 2. So the governor says what this will do is help them a little bit with law enforcement parameters, will help them a little bit more with zoning restrictions, and it just gives the legislature, honestly, a little bit more of a say in how this is going to do. But it also it significantly rewrites the thing that voters are actually voting on. The whole distribution model, they're no longer called dispensaries. Yep. They'll be called cannabis pharmacies. There will be a state sort of DABC style agency on top controlling just five cannabis pharmacies in the state. So it makes a lot of changes that I don't think voters will be aware of going into the election, and might not know what the differences and the similarities will be. I think that's going to be the real elephant in the room for this one.
Why would you mentioned, Julia, that two of the three proponent groups signed off on this compromise? Why would they do that?
That's, I think, still a point of debate. I think they said they wanted to avoid legal battle after the proposition either passed or failed. They also, the word that kept coming up in the presser was good faith. This is we're doing this on good faith, that we think the legislature actually wants to be where we are. And so we're willing to come to the table with them.
But if you are going to win.
Right.
if the numbers suggest, the polling suggests, and it seems that it does, mm-hmm. you're going to win. Why would you do that?
Well, I think it's made people angry, right?
Yeah. Well, and this goes back to the fact that the legislature can come in January if this passes and gut it and do whatever they want. And I think a lot of lawmakers thought that this proposition would go too far. They were worried about people being able to grow their own marijuana if they live too far away from a dispensary. And they thought they really did think it was too broad. I think that the people pushing Proposition 2 realized that and decided that a compromise was better than just having it gutted by the legislature or having that possibility.
But if you live in San Juan County right now, like under the way this compromise was crafted, there's no dispensary or pharmacy or whatever you call it in San Juan County under that. In some ways, it seems restrictive. Far more restrictive than some were hoping.
It's absolutely more restrictive than the initiative. For San Juan County, you have to get to the county health department, mm-hmm. which, given the size of San Juan County, can either be an easy thing or a very, very difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
So there's no question there's going to be areas of the state that are barely covered under this program.
So what I'm interested in what you're seeing, is this driving apart these particular groups? Because you have, on one hand, you have, I know there's a the groups that were together in support of it, now they're in disagreement about whether they should have made these concessions. And the same for those who were opposing Prop 2. You have people like Walter Plum, you know, the kind of the crusader who's been putting a lot of money into opposing this initiative. He doesn't like the compromise. He told you, Ben, or the Tribune anyway, I like to win things. So he's not crazy about it either. And I'm wondering just when you divide up these various groups, both opponents and supporters, what that's going to mean in terms of enthusiasm and turnout and just how this changes the dynamic of this whole thing.
Go for it.
No. He asked you. I'm sorry.
Now, I mean, one thing that I'm curious to see is, there was a lot of talk before this compromise that people haven't read the initiative. They don't know the specifics. They're just voting on this general concept of medical marijuana. What's interesting is this deal has now given us all permission to do that. This deal is now allowing us to say, I'm voting for the concept of medical marijuana because this initiative is never going to see the light of day. So I could see that making these people who were previously on the fence and previously unsure, saying, oh, well, medical marijuana, I'm good with that, so I'm good with this.
Well, because the Mormon Church has come through and said, in theory, we support medical marijuana.
Right. And it's interesting because we're no longer talking about the specifics of initiative Proposition 2. Now we're just talking about medical marijuana and some draft proposal that will be debated in November after the vote.
And that's why you have people like Walter Plum who believe that if they can defeat the proposition, they are sending a signal that they have leverage in this negotiation that will take place after the election is over, that they can either further restrict the deal that they came up with or actually kill it altogether. I think that's what Plum would ultimately like to do with this. And I think that has fed this distrust between the two sides. Not to mention the fact that nearly a quarter of the legislature is in turnover. That means we're going to have a whole new slate of lawmakers coming together in January. So we are essentially passing a compromise with a lame duck legislature. And that can be good or bad, right? It's one of the backers says, well, I'd rather have people that are familiar with the issue that have dealt with this for a couple years now than a whole new slate of lawmakers who have no idea what we've been talking about and what we've been discussing since 2015. But I think that will be a big question.
Julia, you talked about something that Governor Herbert said. I want to play a clip here, and you can set this up for us, because it raises this question of whether or not all this compromise and all of these questions now on this Proposition 2, whether that will drive down enthusiasm and participation in the vote.
This was Ben Wood, actually, and a lot of other journalists raising their hands and going, so what does this actually mean for Proposition 2? And this is what the governor said.
If it passes, we'll fix whatever problems are in the initiative. If it doesn't pass, we're going to come back together and create legislation that encompasses what we've already said we're going to do. So either way, the public at large is going to win on this.
So the governor there saying, listen, we are going to do something. Very politician answer right there.
Yeah. Like it or not, something will happen.
Something will happen, and you will like it.
Well, it does seem to suggest that what we were talking about earlier, when you get citizens groups who get together and put something on the ballot, it does change the dynamic. It didn't end it. I mean, it seems to have moved the needle on this question.
Oh, it definitely moved the needle. I don't think I've ever heard of a time where before the election, there was talk of calling a special session after the election to change or tweak a proposition that is on the ballot. I mean, it may have happened. I don't study legislatures in other states, but this is a really strange thing that's happening and really uncommon.
Yeah, there is a 0% chance that there would be a special session in November on this issue, if not for the initiative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I'm a cynical political reporter. I don't see the point of having one in November anyway, but there definitely wouldn't be one in November without the initiative.
Chances?
Oh, so
if you were a betting woman,
I will just give you the facts, Doug.
Just the facts.
On Thursday, Deseret News came out with Rasmussen poll. So this is the most recent poll. I don't know if it actually included the compromise in the language of the question, but 64% still support Proposition 2. So it really looks like this thing is going to pass. The interesting thing about that poll, though, only 3% are unsure. Hmm. So that means people have already made up their minds about this thing. Regardless of what the legislature and the compromise is going to do, people are, like Ben said, sending a message about the issue of medical marijuana. And they seem to be saying, we want more of it.
Okay, I'm running behind. I haven't even taken a break yet, first break yet. So let's do that. We still got two more initiatives we have to talk about. Ben Wood is with us, a politics and government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He also hosts the Trib Talk podcast. And we have with us Julia Ritchie and Nicole Nixon. They cover politics for KUER News. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Next Wednesday, we're wrapping up our speaker series about diversity in America, and we'll have with us Maria Hinojosa. Hinojosa is the host of NPR's Latino USA, and for years now, her coverage has been giving a voice to minorities and immigrants. You can join us next Wednesday at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. It's a partnership with United Way of Salt Lake City. For tickets and information, go to our website, KUER.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah voters have some important decisions to make next month, from medical marijuana to Medicaid expansion. There's a referendum on gerrymandering. It's a lot to consider, and we have with us a group of journalists here to discuss what they all mean and what's at stake. Nicole Nixon and Julia Ritchie cover politics for KUER News. They're here with us in the studio, along with Benjamin Wood, who covers politics and government for the Salt Lake Tribune, also hosts the Trib Talk podcast. Proposition 3, Julia, what is that? This is a proposition that would fully expand Medicaid under the terms of the Affordable Care Act, basically. And this has been in the works for a while.
Yeah. Since 2012, states have had the option of expanding Medicaid up to 138% of the federal poverty level. That was something that Obamacare was crafted under Obamacare. For the most part, red states were like, nah, we're good. This is too expensive. We don't want to do it. And blue states, in large part, I think almost like 32 states now have actually expanded Medicaid up to that level. So Governor Herbert, again, he tried to do this. This is that incremental approach the legislature tries to take in 2015 with Healthy Utah. Looks a lot like actually what's on the ballot this year. And it failed. I mean, the Republican legislatures did not want to do it, did not want to go along with it. And I believe it was a little bit of an embarrassment for the governor at the time. And so now legislature came back because they saw this proposition creeping up on them. And they
forced their hand again.
And they came up with a partial expansion modeled after a few other red states that have also passed partial expansions up to 100% of the federal poverty level. And it adds a workforce requirement. And the reason they did that is because the Trump administration came in, signaled that they were okay with the work requirement, which has been a kind of a point of debate for the Medicaid program for a long time. And that is currently under federal review. So they partially expanded it, but we're still sort of in this waiting line because you have to get a waiver in order to get Medicaid approved. So that's what the legislature did. And now backers are saying not far enough.
Yeah. We don't like the work requirements.
Yeah, they're calling it a clean expansion. They say it would cover up to 150,000 Utahns. What the legislature did would cover about 50,000. So it's a pretty big difference in the population it would cover.
The backers also want to increase taxes to cover the state's portion.
Correct.
And this is where the tax increase comes.
Right. This is pretty much the other tax increase on your ballot this year, from 4.7% to 4.85% would be the difference there. And that would cover the state's portion of this expansion. So the way it works is the federal government gives us about $800-900 million, and we have to pay the other 10% to cover the program. So that is what the tax increase would cover.
How's it looking?
Pretty good. The last poll I looked up was in October. It's been polling in the upper 60s, so it was 62% last time it was polling. I think there's, again, not a lot of organized opposition. Representative Robert Spindliff, who crafted that partial expansion deal, said, you know, there's just not a lot of people out there right now that are campaigning against this. So
that surprises me a little bit, because this is a Medicaid expansion was a big issue for conservative groups. And the fact that you're not hearing that. That seems interesting to me.
I wonder if it has a lot to do with the Republican Congress failing to repeal the Affordable Care Act. That took a lot of wind out of their sails.
Yeah, they just moved on.
They kind of moved on to the tax cuts. You heard, Paul Ryan's, Obamacare is the law of the land. It's hard to argue that this is going away, that expansion of healthcare programs, especially on the federal level, is going to be repealed at this point, especially as more states move toward expansion.
What's your sense of what will happen, Ben? This, as Julia mentioned, this is pulling pretty well. I guess that's not the question, and maybe that is still the question, whether it passes, but also what do lawmakers do with it if it does?
Yeah, I had a chance to talk with Representative Spindliff last week. I asked him about these compromise efforts, these deals being worked out with the other initiatives. He essentially said if the voters pass this one, he's fine with just putting it in place. He didn't anticipate himself. He wasn't sure about his colleagues, but he felt on this one, if the voters say, let's expand, then it'll expand.
Okay. Chances, if you were betting people?
I think that, again, like Prop 2, Prop 3 has come out with some really compelling stories. The advocates on this side of the initiative have, put a lot of people forward that fall into this coverage gap. These are the people that are they're making too much money to get Medicaid right now, but they don't make enough money to qualify for the generous subsidies of Obamacare.
You want to talk about the person you, Shantae Lowell?
Right. I spoke to a single mom in Farmington. She's recently divorced. She has two kids. One of her kids has a disability, has achondroplasia, which is a type of dwarfism. And she herself suffers from diabetes, lupus, arthritis. And once her divorce was finalized, totally lost her insurance. Her kids are still covered under her ex-husband's policy. She herself, though, between modest alimony, child support, and a part-time job, can't afford all the medications that she needs. And so that was one story where you're like, it's hard to argue that this woman doesn't deserve the sort of health coverage that her family is actually getting, because she is their primary caregiver. And if she can't stay healthy, how is she supposed to take care of her family? And I think those are the kind of gripping personal narratives that can sway voters at the polls.
Okay, anything else to say about that?
No, I'd agree. It appears to be in good position. Like Julie said, this is really similar to Healthy Utah. The state's been debating this for several years. I think there's a sentiment out there that
let's get it over with.
Yeah, it should have been done already. Yeah.
And I will say the other states that did the partial expansions, Kentucky, Arkansas, they have – the reason that the work requirement hasn't been fully implemented yet is –
courts are testing it.
Courts
right?
are testing it. And it's also in Arkansas, 4,300 residents lost Medicaid with the work requirement. So there's actually evidence out there that especially backers of this are using to say this is not a good thing when you put work requirements on this population of people, it actually has the opposite effect of what you're trying to do.
Okay, let's move to Proposition 4. In 2020, lawmakers are going to redraw the electoral boundaries. They take the they take the census numbers and they do it. And it's always a sort of, at least lately, or for a long time, a very political process. Nicole Nixon, talk a little bit about this. Because what's interesting to me is, why would Republican lawmakers who are clearly in control and have been for a long time, why would they want anything like this? But there are Republicans who are on board with this idea.
I think the majority of Republican lawmakers do not want this. Yeah. They currently have the power to they're in charge of redrawing the districts after the census numbers come out. And that is the case in most states. I think there is recently we're seeing a few more states move to these independent redistricting commissions. This is what Proposition 4 would do. Lawmakers would be able to appoint seven commissioners who would not be able to be lawmakers or lobbyists or anybody like that. This commission would be in charge of drawing new maps. The legislature would still get final say. I guess the governor would still get final say.
Yeah.
But the legislature would still get the chance to say yes or no on any new maps that this independent commission brings forward.
Okay. So what's at the heart of this this Better Boundaries initiative? The incentive that you're, as you said, there seems to be a trend nationally. People are just tired of the partisan nature of this. They just seem ridiculously unfair.
I think so. I think that there is a weariness of this nationally. Utah was no different than the rest of the country in 2011. It was very partisan. There was a lot of fighting going on among the lawmakers on the commission that were doing that. I remember they were requesting each other. You know, the Democrats were requesting the Republicans' internal communications and vice versa. And I think Democrats, when the new maps came out and were passed and went into effect, feel like they got the very short end of the stick on this one. I think the Democrats lost some House seats in the 2012 election. Congressman Jim Matheson, who was a Democrat, had a much harder time keeping his seat and eventually retired. And I think Utah Democrats just feel like they really do not have a voice in Congress. We're represented by six Republicans in the House and the Senate. They're really fired up about this one.
Yeah. So it's interesting when you think about how are people talking about the districts like Salt Lake County, which are more liberal? How do Republicans justify not just giving the Dems their own district? I mean, there's the population for it. How does it work? Do you know what I mean?
Well, Senator Todd Weiler's been kind of the big
– Yeah, he's the Republican state senator.
Yeah, he thinks that this is exactly what you said, a way for Democrats to gerrymander their own district.
Yeah.
And believes that the way that it's apportioned now is the best way to apportion districts. It's the debate between pizza slices and a donut.
Yeah.
Just a delicious debate that we're having right now.
Explain that.
So right now, Salt Lake County is divided into pizza slices.
Yes.
And four congressional districts.
Everyone gets a cut.
Right. Everyone gets a cut. But the way that he argues that Democrats and more liberal people would want it is a donut, where we would have our own singular congressional district. And I don't think it has to be either or. I don't think that's actually what the backers of Better Boundaries are necessarily arguing for. I think it has a lot to do with we are 39th in the country for voter turnout, and a big reason is because we lack competitive races.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the high-minded argument for this one from Better Boundaries is, if we had more competitive districts, we would have better turnout, and as a result, we would have better representation. Maybe we wouldn't have so many citizen ballot initiatives either, because our representatives would be more reflective of where we live and what our values are as voters.
I think what's interesting about that, Nicole, as you mentioned, most Republican lawmakers are opposed to it. But there are a number of conservative Republicans mm-hmm. who actually support the idea.
Yeah, there is this idea. I mean, the Better Boundaries campaign uses the quotes from Ronald Reagan that gerrymandering is evil and that there should be bipartisan commissions all over the country to redraw districts. And there are some Republicans who support this and who think that it would lead to better accountability of politicians. And that it would lead to more transparency in the process. And they don't feel like they have much to lose. I mean, Utah is still very conservative. It is a supermajority state. There are Republicans who just, you know, want to level the playing field a little bit, make it more of a fair game.
Yeah, and if you're skeptical of government in general, if you're a small government conservative, mm-hmm. then the idea of allowing elected lawmakers to draw their own seats is uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just kind of clashes with that distrust of government bureaucracy. And so to make the argument that to pull that out of partisan politics, give it to an independent board with oversight of the legislature, it's hard to argue against.
Although support is sort of mixed on this one,
well,
too.
Well, that's the cookie.
Yeah, what I think is interesting about polling is that for the past year or so, there's been about 20 to 25% of voters are undecided on this. And
so interesting.
I don't know if that means that people aren't sure what this would do. It's a few years away when we would actually see this materialize. I have noticed that support among Republicans has waned in the last few months, in the last year or so. I think that there are still Republicans who, you know, at the end of the day, you're playing politics, and they don't want to give up any amount of power for their party.
Well, what did Senator Wyler say to you? To the victor and goes the spoils.
Yeah, it's part of the spoils of war. If you're playing the game, you know, and you're winning elections, then maybe you deserve a little bit more power.
Did he really say, "Don't hate the player, hate the game"?
No,
that's sort of what he said, though.
Okay, so this one's harder to guess, right? What do you figure?
This one is hard. There's a lot of uncertainty, like yeah. I said in the mm-hmm. polling. You know, Julia mentioned how with marijuana it's 3% undecided. This one has something like 20-odd undecided. And depending on how that block splits, we'll really decide how this goes.
Mm-hmm. Up in the air right now. Nobody knows.
Yeah, I'm not seeing a lot of Prop 4 yard signs outside yeah. of people. I'm seeing yeah. a lot of Prop 2 signs, a few Prop 3, but none.
I mean, we're not seeing as many radio buys, television buys. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Better Boundaries, I looked at their forms. They're sitting on quite a bit of money at the moment, and I'm not exactly sure what
they're
doing.
They have ads, though. I think I saw a TV ad last night on this one, and I am seeing a few yard signs here and there, but they're mostly in Salt Lake City, where, again, liberals are feeling unrepresented.
Some final thoughts here. Let's sort of move past. I don't want to talk about the constitutional amendments, A, B, and C.
We don't either.
Oh, my favorite.
I'm just wondering, though, these initiatives, is this driving a kind of excitement that you might not see for voter? And what's your sense of how this might or might not be driving voter turnout this year?
Yeah, I mean, especially before the Proposition 2 deal was announced, there was a lot of excitement around the medical marijuana vote. Whether that excitement is still there,
yeah,
not so sure.
Right.
But all leading up to this year, there was more talk about this election than we typically see in a midterm.
I think voters, especially in a more liberal-leaning Salt Lake County, feel that this is the year that their vote actually counts for something. If you're worried about your vote never counting in the state, these propositions actually give you a way to make a difference in the issues and policies that you care about. So I think it will drive more voters. I talked to Sherry Swinson, the Salt Lake County clerk, yesterday. Since last month, they have had 15,000 additional voter registration forms mailed in.
Wow.
And she said they are on pace to exceed previous midterm election cycles, which typically have lower turnout. But because of these propositions on really hot button issues, we could see a record turnout this year.
Wait, she thinks that it's because of these ballot initiatives, not the Kavanaugh hearings or the Trump
dissatisfaction? I think it's a three thing. So I think it's the initiatives. I think a statewide Senate race is always going to get people interested, especially with longtime Senator Orrin Hatch finally leaving. And I think this blue wave that we've been hearing about, there's a lot of people that are really unhappy with the way things are going in Washington.
She said it.
The most competitive race, Utah, the race for the 4th congressional district. This has got to be driving voter interest anyway, yes?
Right.
Yeah, particularly in that district.
Yeah. The Taylor Swift bump. Roll Call wrote this. At least one voter registration website has seen a massive spike in Americans, especially young ones, signing up to vote after the music superstar Taylor Swift urged her Instagram followers to hit the polls this November. Has anyone spent some time with the Taylor Swift bump?
I'm only voting because Taylor Swift is I
asked Sherry Swinson about this yesterday. I was like, did you see a Tay-Tay bump or Tay-Swift bump? And she said, of the people, this is anecdotally, of course, that the people she saw, that because the mail-in deadline was like Thursday, she said they were of all ages. Although I will say Taylor Swift is a pop star who appeals to all ages. She is the voice of a generation.
I will say that turnout among young people has historically been very low, especially in Utah. And with the Taylor Swift Instagram post and earlier this year, the March for Our Lives movement, I wouldn't be surprised if we see a little more turnout among young people. I hope that's the case, but I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah, we'll have to see in all these, won't we?
We will.
Yeah, we will. That's a good final word. Okay. Benjamin Wood, politics and government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, host of the Trib Talk podcast. Thank you for coming in. Julia Ritchie and Nicole Nixon, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Of KUER News, they cover politics. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Tim Slover directed the show today, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.